There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the deal we got? I mean, the deal we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
Right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along. Live local talk over the next hour. And it's always a treat when I get to do it with a guy I'm a big, big fan of. And I tell you, a friend of mine and historian extraordinaire for the city of Mobile and a dang good author as well. Some of my favorite books, the ones that get the middle position on the bookshelf at home, are written by my friend John Sledge, who joins us now. Hey, John.
Sean, thank you so much.
Hey, it's a treat to do this, and hopefully, you know, people have tuned in the past. We've talked about all kind of local history. This one will be benchmarked somewhat with the calendar, because coming up this weekend, I think Sunday, it's the, well, we have the reenactment we'll talk about, but 207 years since the Fort Mims massacre?
Years. Yeah. It was pretty amazing.
Lay out to this. I mean, I think most of us have a walking around knowledge of the Fort Mims massacre, but not your knowledge. Can you lay out kind of the, and then we'll expand, but the short story of what led to the Fort Mims massacre and why we're remembering it 207 years later?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And what astonishes me about it is how alive it still is in the imagination here, because there's so many people who can trace their ancestry back to survivors, victims on both sides. So it's very much a part of the culture. It really began the Creek Indians, who dominated Alabama east of the Alabama River and on into Georgia as well, were under terrific stress from the growing infant United States. Mobile had just come under U.S. from Spain. There was a lot of pressure from the east, pioneers and so forth. The Federal Road had been cut through, roughly following the path of I-65 today. So large numbers of settlers were pressing into the area. And at the same time, the federal government was trying to assimilate the Creeks, teach them agriculture, plantation agriculture, settle them down, wean them away from their traditional culture, and try to, you know, turn them into Christian Protestant settlers. And some of the Indians were more amenable to that than others, and some were better at it than others, and some did quite well, particularly in this area, and prospered, and then others really wanted to cleave more to the traditional way. So as that pressure grew from the United States, there was a pushback on the part of the traditional Creeks to retain their culture and not give up everything that they had known. And so that was really the fundamental argument that was at the core of the entire struggle. And of course, by the time of Fort Mims, there'd been a lot of racial intermixture, not just between the whites and the Indians, but African slaves as well. So you had a very racially complex area. Creek society was matrilinear, of course, and so you had a lot of families that were related but were on different sides of the issue. And so you got this real strong civil war going between the Creek Indians, and then the Americans got mixed up in it. And then there were the African slaves in the middle, and I'm sure for many of them the calculation was, what is going to be best for me? What are my chances? Am I going to do better with the Americans, or might I become free if, you know, the Creeks held black slaves as well? So it put a lot of people in a very difficult position, and it really all came to just a perfect storm at Fort Mims.
We talk about the diversity side of it, too, as it's being discussed today. If people read history and read your accounts, too, that like you mentioned, that diversity was very present in our area here on the frontier. And I want to talk about the frontier because this, at that point, was the wild, wild west. Alabama was, this was the edge of the edge of the wilderness.
Yeah, and it's a mistake to think about Fort Mims as white settlers and red Indians. And that's kind of sometimes the more traditional image people have. And in reality, there were a lot of what archaeologists now call Métis, or what they would have called mixed bloods in an earlier day, people who were part Indian, part white, or various mixtures. And oftentimes they were related. They all knew one another. And there were old smoldering resentments that went back over various issues among different ones of them. So that by the time of the actual battle, they were actually yelling insults back and forth. You know, it was a very personal affair. It wasn't impersonal at all. And you had just this vicious nature to that fighting that you often have, unfortunately, with civil wars.
So you lay out this frontier. We've got this burgeoning republic of the United States of America. We have the Creeks that have big land holdings that, you know, that we had eyes on, of course, and designs with the settlers.
Amen.
And then you had some other players here. I mean, you talked about the United States being, you know, Spanish getting out, and the United States moving in from Mobile, but we weren't some world power. We were a tiny mite that people had designs on.
This is true, but by 1813, of course, the Spanish were pushed out. The British still, of course, had designs on the area that would only be quashed by Jackson at New Orleans in 1815. But there was a lot of population growth and pressure coming down from the east. And so the Indians were really, they did well when they could play these powers off against each other. But as those numbers diminished, when Spain took over West Florida from Britain, that became less advantageous for the Indians. And as the Americans began to assume power, even less so. So they really found their options declining, and the Americans were just so land hungry. The Indians were hunting all of these thousands, millions of acres because they depended on the deer hides. That's what they would send to Europe, and that was the basis of their economy. They were totally dependent on European and Western trade goods, you know, hatchets and muskets and cloth and things like that. And so here were the Americans, and they thought allowing all those millions of acres just as hunting land was a waste. They wanted to be able to farm it and settle it, and that just created this tension that couldn't be resolved any other way, unfortunately.
So we go to those tensions. We laid out that story, and later on in the hour I want to expand on kind of the bigger story of it, but that comes to a head at Fort Mims. Describe, for people who haven't been up there or seen it, Fort Mims, size of Fort Mims, settlement around Fort Mims. What are we talking about, John?
It was called the Tensaw Settlement, so it was backcountry. You had mills, you had farms, you had dog-trot houses and barns, widely scattered holdings. And Fort Mims was actually centered on the residence of a guy named Samuel Mims, and he had a brother named David up there. There was a ferry up there across the Alabama River, so there was a small rural economy, and Mims basically built a palisade around his property. It was enclosed about an acre of land, and you imagine as the Indian troubles increased and larger numbers of people sort of forted up for safety, eventually you had over 400 people within that one-acre compound, and imagine this kind of weather, exactly this time of year, this August heat, this insufferable humidity, drenching rains, these whining mosquitoes and gnats and yellow flies, and 400 people jammed into this compound with forests and swamps and a potato field around them, and black slaves and mixed race people and white militia, and you know, you're trying to have a garrison there and beat the drums for the troops to come to dinner, and children are running around and dogs are running around and everybody's irritable and hot. And they began to get lax because there was no immediate attack, just lots of rumors. People thought, well, maybe the danger is not as imminent as we thought it was. And so famously, the sand washed against the gate and nobody had done anything about it. So the gate's sitting there stuck in an open position and people are sweltering, and they send out occasional patrols, but not as often as they should. And a lot of these folks are not you know, trained as soldiers. They're just ordinary volunteers or farmers. And they were kind of like us all in pandemic. They were fed up with it, but the danger was still out there lurking unseen.
And watching, you know, those descriptions.
And in fact, the famous story of the young black slaves who went out to tend the cattle, who saw these painted parties of Indians, you know, clad only in loincloths and painted in these fierce colors and carrying these weapons, these red sticks, these heavy sharpened clubs. And they went back and told the garrison, and they sent out a little patrol, and they didn't find anybody, and so they tied the slaves up and whipped them for spreading rumors. And this was the worst possible thing they could have done, because then those slaves, when they saw Indians again, they didn't know what to do. Do we tell and get whipped again, or do we try to slip away? I mean, obviously trouble is brewing here.
Yeah, they see, I mean, in your description and others I've read, these slaves, they see the Creek warriors. They come back and say, they're painted warriors out there. They're,
exactly.
And he, Beasley just says,
yeah,
I can't find them.
Yeah, no big deal. I didn't try very hard. And it's and there were also some design problems with the fort as well. It wasn't fully complete. It was a flimsy palisade. It had a blockhouse at one corner. But when the attack would actually come, there weren't any soldiers in it. And the gate, of course, was stuck open. And then rather than having a fire step around the inside walls where the men could shoot over the top of the palisade above their attackers, or having holes, you know, 6 or 7 feet up with a fire step, they had these holes in the palisade spaced only about 4 feet off the ground. Well, the upshot was is that whoever controlled that loophole, whether they were on the inside or the outside, could fire. So all the Indians had to do was gain the walls, and they could fire in just as easily as the settlers could fire out.
Shooting
and
gallery.
That ended up being just a fatal design flaw in the fort itself, because once the Indians achieved surprise, they were able to get command of those holes in the wall and shoot the settlers like, you know, fish in a barrel.
Coming right back. More with John Sledge. We're talking about 270 years since the Fort Mims Massacre. By the way, I guess they're not deterred. That's good. They have the reenactment going on this weekend. 2 days. We'll talk more about that and more about Alabama history when we return.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Call Sean now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Continuing the conversation with John Sledge. And people sent me pictures of where they've purchased some of the books of John's I've recommended over time. Y'all are going to be real happy. And people in the text line telling me they've done the same. John, the most recent book out is The Gulf of Mexico, right?
That's correct, yeah.
And because somebody earlier said, I want to buy the one that has a lot about the pirates in it.
That's what that would be the Gulf, yeah.
a lot of pirates, and that comes in with the story of this time frame, too, if you extend it on to the Battle of New Orleans. Talking about specifically Fort Mims and the massacre at this point here, so we've kind of laid out the scenario of what was there at Fort Mims and the stockade and the palisades and poorly kept up, poorly defended. And even reports of painted warriors, Creek Indians, nearby. So then play out the day leading up to the massacre. And let's talk about probably the biggest name here that we still remember, and that's William Weatherford, or Red Eagle.
Yeah, exactly. The major personality on the side of the Creeks, really interesting guy, and a extremely adroit politically within the Creek social structure. He knew how to organize and put together a real coalition to resist the whites, which he did very effectively. And he was really more white than he was Indian, and but because of his mother's side, he had a strong kinship tie with the Wynn clan, and so he was a real forceful and energetic leader, and really a statesman as well. And Fort Mims was both his greatest success and his greatest failure, because once the attack got underway, which was Weatherford's decision. He realized he could hear the drums beating in the fort. Historians aren't sure if they were beating the tattoo for lunch or if they were beating the tattoo for all hands to witness punishment, the whipping of one of the slaves for spreading so supposed false rumors. But in any case, he felt like perhaps they've seen us, perhaps we've been spotted, we need to attack now. And so then they rushed the stockade. Once the battle actually began, though, and he began to realize that the Greeks going to win, but it was, they were going to essentially, there was going to be a lot of killing after the shooting stopped. He essentially rode away. He couldn't bear to witness it. He knew he couldn't stop it. And he also realized that this would be the thing that really destroyed his people, because the whites would want such a vengeance after this happened that, almost like Little Bighorn in Europe, mm-hmm. with the Pyrrhic victory. So the Indians rushed the compound, and you can just imagine, you know, that it's at high noon on a hot August day, and nobody's expecting this, and all of a sudden the screaming and whooping, and the gates are open, and here they come. And the Indians are led by the so-called prophets, these religious figures who were part of this movement, religious movement within the Creek Nation, to bring them back to more traditional ways. And the prophets had done various types of rituals and ceremonies to convince their warriors that they would be impervious to the musket balls of the enemy. Of course, that wasn't true, but they led the attack into the compound, and almost immediately it became just a vicious hand-to-hand melee. Eventually, Beasley tried to shut the gate, of course, and was shot or knifed in the stomach and managed to get behind the gate, but perished there. And from that point on, it was really just a pitched battle, more a battle than a massacre for a couple of hours. There was a bitter fight at the gate. The settlers tried to regain control and get the gate shut. But then the issue, of course, were those holes in the walls where the Indians fire into the compound. And you had a lot of civilians mixed up with the white militia and the Creek Métis within the compound. So you can imagine just the chaos and the terror and the screaming and the butchery and savagery of this kind of killing, much of it with knives and edged weapons by hand. And some of the whites actually got up into the attic of the men's house and knocked shingles out and sort of used that as a perch from which to fire down on the enemy. But they had no artillery, and they had really lost control of their perimeter. And then the Indians got the idea, well, let's shoot flaming arrows onto these roofs, and that'll deprive the enemy of their cover. And once those buildings caught fire, then it was all over. The many whites and mixed breeds died in the fires. Others were trapped, and in the end, it just became a ghastly kill zone. The Indians did not slaughter everyone. They took about 100 people captive, women, children, as well as some black slaves. About maybe 15 or 20 people were able to escape, slip out of the walls, run into the swamps, eventually make their way to Fort Stoddart and Mobile. And then as the smoke from these buildings sort of billowed up into the blue sky, this black smoke, everybody from miles around realized that warfare had come to the tinsel. And so the following weeks were just consumed in rage and panic and further raiding and by smaller war parties in the area, and then of course Andrew Jackson's determination to fight to get revenge and boot the Indians out for good.
How much, and there's so much here to talk about, I'm just picturing the faces of those that crossed the river system and ended up at Fort Stoddart or Mobile, and the story had to tell. I can't imagine at that point.
The descriptions. I mean, Judge Tolman was there, and he talked about those first canoes and rowboats sort of coming across. Just abject terror on these people, in some cases women and children who had escaped, in one case an African girl. They were practically incoherent. And then when the first Americans began to filter into the area days after the battle, they just described wild dogs running everywhere, just terror-stricken and traumatized. I can imagine many of these, you know, their owners had been killed and whatnot. So it was just a, chaotic backwash of violence and a horrible time.
And we got just a minute here until the break, and then we'll talk more about this. But the, you know, you talk about what broke out after that, and we know some of the bigger history stories of the Creek Indian War. But I mean, you drive up to Jackson, Alabama, and see homes where families were killed and pulled out, and Fort Sinclefield, yeah, and all that. I mean, in the Forks, yeah, as they called it, right? The Clark County.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah, I mean, it was going to, essentially, the Creeks were going to just root the Americans completely out of the backcountry. And
but not just forts, right? I mean, settlements, wherever. No, I mean, there's a cabin.
And that's why, in Fort Mims, there were other little settlements like it that had little forts and blockhouses where people could shelter. Of course, you couldn't stay in those places for long. And the U.S. military had a presence at Stoddart and in Mobile, but it wasn't strong.
All right, we're up against a break. Coming right back, more with John Sledge. We're talking about what goes on this weekend and 207. Actually, they're saying it's the 208th reenactment at Fort Mims this weekend, and we'll talk more about this when we return.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Talking history this hour with a friend of mine who happens to be a historian extraordinaire for our greater region and, of course, us right here on the Alabama Gulf Coast. John Sledge continues the discussion. And people ask me about different books here. So, John, once again, the most recent is which one?
The Gulf of Mexico, a Maritime History.
All right, people can get that. I'm the uber fan of the Mobile River. That's still in print.
Still in print, yes. Thank you.
You gotta have it, y'all. If you live here, you gotta have it and read that book. We're talking about Fort Mims, but the bigger story around that as well, the Creek Indian War. What about this? I mean, here you had Jackson, who I want to let you detail Andrew Jackson's time in Mobile in a little bit, but had Andrew Jackson, everything I've read, he really wanted to push further against the Indians, so the Creek Indians. This was Fort Mims, I'm sure, sad for him, but was it a go? Was it a checkered flag for Jackson?
Oh, absolutely. That's a good description. He was in Tennessee. In fact, he was recovering from a ghastly wound he had gotten in one of these vicious personal duels he got involved in, and was at death's door on his bed when the news of Fort Mims reached Nashville. And one of his loyal lieutenants, you know, brought him the news and said, you know, General, I only regret that you yourself will not be able to take the field. And Jackson leaned up on his elbow and said, the devil in hell, I will not. And that was the moment he had been waiting for. He knew that seething anger among the white settlers for revenge would be the motivation to launch his attack, and so he did. He brought the Tennessee Volunteers, the militia down from the north. There was an army from Georgia, another one, Mississippi Volunteers as well. So the Creeks had three armies converging on them, and Jackson was fiercely determined to stamp them out, take their land from them. Of course, he was already resenting them because of their liaisons with the British theretofore and getting powder and all from Pensacola and entertaining runaway slaves and things like that. So there were a number of reasons Jackson wanted to wipe them off the map.
I guess we do need to point out, too, if people that we're talking about these international powers at play during this period,
yeah,
of time, the British were as close as Pensacola and
yeah,
were they'd picked a side. They were, you know, anybody against the Americans, right? I mean, we talk about and how does, yeah, Murder Creek, people have crossed that a bunch going up 65, how does that play into this?
You know, I don't know the exact story of Murder Creek. Of course, Burnt Corn Creek, yeah, happened in South Alabama as well, when a party of Red Sticks coming out of Pensacola with powder and ball were ambushed by Americans and ended up turning the tables on them because the Americans got more interested in plundering their train than following up on the victory. But yes, there were all kind of struggles and skirmishes. The canoe fight, famously, after Fort Mims on the Alabama River. But there were all kind of confrontations. The whole frontier really was on fire. And, of course, the Indians were, they weren't, of course, you know, people with Jackson would have seen them as savages, but they were not irrational players, and they were not evil people. They had legitimate reasons for them to have the position that they had. Their society was under stress, and they were simply trying to preserve their way of life that they had known for millennia. And, you know, it's a profoundly tragic and sad story that these diverse peoples could not live together. It came to violence.
Indeed. And by the way, just a side note, y'all, you need to read in the Mobile River the description of the canoe fight that John just quickly moved past, which is the best description of that fight that has ever been written. It's It makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck. Y'all read that and see what I'm talking about. You talk about the diverse people, too. And as much as I've been trying to study over probably the last 5 or 6 years what was going on in the Creek Nation, you mentioned Red Sticks, and then you had White Sticks, right?
Yeah, White Sticks is actually a more recent term. That we don't think they used that in the 18-teens, but it became a useful term later to distinguish between the friendly or peaceful factions, the Creeks, and then the warlike factions, the Red Sticks, who were named for their war clubs, which were actually painted or stained red.
Now, we talked about William Weatherford, talked about Red Eagle earlier in the Matrilineal Society. I also am fascinated by, you know, here comes Jackson. He can rally troops. There's a little bit of similarity, right? I mean, there until federal troops are injected in the War of 1812, I mean, you had to have a personality to be able to rally troops, right, and get militias from states. And it seems like on the Creek side, Weatherford would, I mean, I know you had the religious folks and the shamans trying to do, but
right.
He had to, I mean, nobody from the Creek Nation had to go to war, right? You had to convince them.
No, exactly. And, of course, they could see what was happening, and there were winners and losers within their society as things changed, and as there always are. But Weatherford was a great persuader, a great leader, and the Creeks had had quite a number of those in their history. Extraordinary men, really. As was Jackson. I mean, he was just a force of nature. And the famous story of when Weatherford actually went and surrendered to Jackson at Fort Jackson after Fort Mims and Horseshoe Bend, and, you know, Weatherford said, "I would fight you if I could, but all my warriors are dead, and only the women and children are left, and they're going to starve. And I ask compassion." And some of the soldiers wanted to string Weatherford up right there, but Jackson was so impressed with his courage to walk into an armed camp like that and just say, "Look, I would defy you if I could, but I can't anymore." Jackson really respected that.
Probably spoke to Jackson's personality of wanting to fight no matter what.
Personality, personal courage. Of course, for the Indians, you know, the irony is that Fort Mims was one of the greatest victories of the Indian Wars, of 400 years of confrontation. But unfortunately, it ended up being the catalyst, or as you say, the checkered flag that unleashed this revenge on them, and it ultimately led to their removal in the 1830s, and their ceding by the Treaty of Fort Jackson of something like 21 million acres to the United States. So much of the state of Alabama, big portion of Georgia and Mississippi, all come into the country as a result of directly of what happened at Fort Mims.
Do you think that was, when you look at was it just following Jackson, or was it that possible promise of land that motivated Tennesseans to follow Jackson south into this wilderness and to this fight against the Indians? Or was
For them, they probably had their diverse reasons, but greed was part of it. They knew they had a lot to gain. In some cases, they may have been compelled. They might have been fleeing a bad man. I mean, all kind of reasons, but there was a powerful inclination for young men to pick up and follow Jackson south. They felt like he was a winner, he was a leader, and that they knew this was rich land and that they would personally prosper. This would set them up for the future. You know, if I can go on campaign and then have a comfortable little living afterwards, a nice piece of land that I can pass on in good country, that was a powerful motivation.
Yeah, and some huge blocks of land were awarded after that.
Just prime land, too. I mean, you think how beautiful Alabama is, you know, in this time of year when you're driving or flying over, just these g- g- green hills and these beautiful streams, and what a blessed land. And that was just prime country.
I want to get a lot of questions here. Dan's, I want to ask first here. So he said, were these all Creek Indians? How did the Choctaws or Malvilla or other Muskegon tribes play into this? Were the Malvilla even around?
Well, the Malvilla would not have been referred to that by that term, or the Mobile Indians would have blended earlier into a Choctaw Muskogean people. The Choctaws were, in general, allied with the Good Creeks, though there were some on the other side as well. And the Choctaws were prevalent in our area and west of the Alabama River. And in fact, some people think that the Mowa peoples of northern Mobile County — I'm by no means an expert on a really complex story — but some people have argued that the Mowas are descendants, or can trace descent from, some Choctaw warriors who actually fought with the Red Sticks at Fort Mims. And then during the retribution that came after, many of them fled, rather than being removed, were able to flee and hide in the swamps, where their descendants still live in the area today. Now, again, I don't know the truth of that, but there certainly were Choctaws involved, not in larger numbers.
And we think about the Creeks, and a story came up the other day. Of course, we have the Porch Bandit Creek Indians here, but
yes,
the majority of those Creeks — we had it was a story the other day about a federal ruling, I think, and it was on the Creek Reservation in Oklahoma. And it was a federal story about who had jurisdiction there. But that's where a lot of the Creek Nation went, right?
That's very true. You'll see similar names out there. And yes, the Porch Band is still a very proud group, and they have an excellent history museum up there at their land, and it's a pretty extraordinary story. And, you know, they're still a force in Alabama politics, and development, certainly Owa and Wind Creek, are they're very much a part of Alabama going forward, which is completely appropriate.
All right. Before we go to the break, too, I did get this update. Thank you. They have canceled the reenactment for this year for Fort Mims because of coronavirus. So they're not doing the reenactment this year. Hopefully, we'll be doing that next year. When we come back, as we wrap it up today, you mentioned something. You and I had a conversation during the news break, and I was talking about the No Alabama, K-N-O-W, No Alabama textbook that so many of us had in school, and you talk about MADOC, and there may be a lot of folks in the state that don't know about this. Can we talk some MADOC and the legend of MADOC when we get back?
Of course.
All right, we'll do that. You don't want to miss this. Part of Alabama lore that you can add to your repertoire. We'll check the news and Dr. Bill's forecast and come right back.
Is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Continue our conversation with John Sledge. By the way, Paul Feinbaum's show about 10 minutes away, 11 minutes away. Be close to accurate there. And John, before we talk MADOC, I do want people to realize that the Creek Indian War, which I think I'm part of the club with you, that doesn't get the attention it should, and the War of 1812 that doesn't get the attention it should out there. Some pretty darn big names in American history were all, like, let's take Horseshoe Bend. Who was there?
Sure. Andrew Jackson, famously. Sam Houston, of course, who would go on to fame in Texas. He was a young lieutenant. I think he was only 18 or 19. Was wounded twice in the thigh by arrows. Davy Crockett, of course, the famous buckskin-clad Tennessean, was there.
Davy Crockett, y'all. I think that's good. Davy Crockett was at Horseshoe Bend.
Yeah, William Coffey was the a cavalry commander for the Americans as well. And the site is an incredible site. It's a national park, well worth visiting. The Tallapoosa River makes just this hairpin bend right there, and you can get a real sense of what that battlefield looked like, and it's a very moving sight to visit.
For sure. All right. This MADOC thing. Let's talk about this, because this came up because you and I were talking about the No Alabama textbook, even though I told you my son came home with his book. Yeah. It's called something else new now, but it's our Alabama history book from school, I think many of us had in school. And you said, well, it, you know, it had Madoc in it. And maybe there's a lot of people that, okay, so let's talk about this. Maybe somebody's read, they've been up at Mentone or Little River and read something. What is the legend of Madoc? What is this story?
Well, and for years, there was a historic marker down at Fort Morgan saying mm-hmm. that he had landed in Mobile Bay. And Madoc was a 12th century Welsh prince who, as far as we know, existed. And the old stories say he fled dynastic war to the west. And that's pretty much all the legends say, but there's been a lot of backfilling since then. And in the 16th century, a lot of Englishmen found the legend useful to give them a prior claim to the New World. In other words, if they could say Madoc landed in the Americas before Columbus, then they would have a claim over Spain on the New World. So said, Madoc from Wales went over. And fairly early on, Mobile Bay was posited as the place where he landed, that his men went up the river system, and that there are these strange stone fortifications in Georgia and Tennessee and northern Alabama that at the time, anyway, and they, certainly even in the 19th century, people didn't think the American Indians were either capable or that it matched what they normally built. And so they thought, well, who put these here? And then there are these stories, fantastic stories of Welsh-speaking Indians and so forth, and it became quite a craze among the intelligentsia in the 18th and 19th centuries, and the legend still has lots of adherents today. And this marker was put up at Fort Morgan in 1953 about this is where he landed. Frederick blew it down. It was kept in storage. It's since been restored by the Daughters of the American Revolution, and they've erected it behind their house on North Joachim Street, where you can go and see it. So most archaeologists will say there's no conclusive evidence. It's most likely a legend that served other purposes, and hence its longevity. But the fact that it made it into that No Alabama textbook seeded it within the imaginations of a whole generation of young Alabamians like yourself and me, and we've some cases passed it on. It's been rinsed from current textbooks because it's not good history. But it's a fascinating legend, and I've always had enough affection for it.
Yeah, it's this, and it's, you address this in the most recent Mobile Bay magazine. People can pick up and read about this, but this idea that you had this, I don't know, kingdom or under Madoc that it existed and predated, like all this stuff. When you hear the people up around Mentone, Alabama, talk about it, they've filled in every blank. They have a story. They can tell you like side people's names and everything to do with this.
Well, and people find that it handily fits the explanations for a lot of otherwise strange mysteries. Even the Mandan peoples, and up in the Missouri, many people felt that they were descendants of the Welsh, and because they had these little hide boats, curas, like they would have made in the British Isles, not like birch bark canoes or dugouts. And so people would point to all kind of little quirks like that, and they'd trace these people all over the map. Similar to what you have with the lost colony of Roanoke and the Lumbee Indians in North Carolina and people who might have intermixed with Europeans very early on. But the Madoc story is our own little piece of early American exploration, and it's a fun story to tell.
And with your explanation there, I've never thought about it that way. It makes more sense. The desire to push this story was based on trying to have the first footprint of the New World, to say they were pre-Columbian, right?
In fact, one Elizabethan scholar went to Queen Elizabeth. He got a meeting, and he laid out what he said was the evidence, and she was convinced it worked for her. And so shortly after that, she commissioned Sir Walter Raleigh on his colonization scheme. So the British very much wanted their foot in the door, and that gave them a little bit of wallpaper to put over it.
Okay, so then this brings, before we wrap, if we talk about people trying to be the first one in, what do you give the, is it the same kind of legend, or does it bear out better that it was actually Leif Erikson first in the New World, you know, in Newfoundland than it was Columbus?
Well, you know, certainly there's strong documented evidence, including archaeological finds, that the Vikings did make it to Newfoundland, Nova Scotia. They were up on that northeastern portion of North America. And that dates back to the, 11th or 12th century. That's pretty well known. And they had a fairly tenuous colony there. So there's no doubt that the Vikings were certainly here then. They were not able to exploit it or expand upon it. It's certainly possible and theoretically possible that other European peoples, even peoples from other parts of the world, could have gotten here by sea. But finding reliable evidence of that is a heavy lift.
But it's probably not. It probably wasn't MADOC. We can go ahead and cross that out.
Probably not MADOC, but who the heck knows?
It's fun to talk about for sure. All right, they go pick up the magazine now. Can read about it or
no? That should be in the. That'll probably be in the October issue.
October issue, Mobile Bay Magazine. The overall headline. Promote
MADOC's
yourself.
MADOC's mark, the persistence of an Alabama legend.
All right, we'll be checking it out then, and remind folks too, because they're always on the text line. Ask me how can they get your books. Where do they go?
I appreciate that. I really do. Yes, Amazon, local bookstores, they can get it for you.
All right, very good. Anything you want to sneak preview? I mean, are you with the COVID and the quarantine, are you working on any new project here?
Yeah, I am. Thank you for asking. I'm working on a big research project about the links, centuries-long links between Havana and Mobile. We're sister cities. We went down there back in the fall, had a really great trip, and it turns out our cities are bound by hundreds of years of history, and I'm working on the book with some other folks to really explore that and present it.
No doubt. I am looking forward to that. John Sledge, as always, it is a pleasure, and we'll get you back on soon.
Thanks, Sean, so much.
All right, John Sledge joining us here, and always good time. And a lot of text here. This one, unnamed texter, but great-great-grandfather fought the Creek War with the 1st Alabama Militia that was paid in land, 80 acres in Coffee and Covington counties. Yeah, although Coffee got enough land, they named a county after him, right? Some of those landholdings that came from the people that fought with Jackson in the Creek Indian War were something. Now, you wonder how it got cut up over time, but some big blocks of land. All right, I'm out of here, and I'll be back tomorrow. We'll do this again for our Friday for Midday Mobile, the Paul Feinbaum Show on the way. Couple heads up here, too. We'll get more from Dr. Bill, looking at, number one, what's going on with now, I believe, tropical storm, or maybe even downgraded beyond that, of Laura, but was a Category 4 hurricane when it came on shore in southwest Louisiana. He'll give us updates on that and maybe what's next out there in the tropics. Also, remember, tomorrow morning, it's Dan Brennan, Dalton Norwig, Mobile Mornings, and check them out from 6 to 9, and then the Jeff Poor Show. And if you want to check out podcasts, Jeff's show and one of his guests in his third hour today, so around 11:30, was Mobile City Councilman Fred Richardson, who has put his hat in the ring, running for mayor. If you'd like to hear that interview, it's up on our podcast page. You can go straight to fmtalk1065.com and click podcast, or better yet, subscribe at iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, any of those places to have our podcast. All right, Feinbaum on the way. See y'all tomorrow.